Hello, listeners. This podcast is hosted by International Idea. In the next minutes, we will help you make sense of what's happening today in democracy worldwide.
Welcome to Democracy Ideas. It's a podcast about all things connected to the future of democracy in the world, run by the Institute for Democracy and Electoral Assistance based in Stockholm. My name is Alistair Scrutton, and I'm the head of communications for International Idea. The IPCC report this year has really shown the urgency and the existential crisis that climate change has put towards humanity and the future of democracy. And if there is one thing that really stands out, both with the IPCC report this year and many, many other scientific studies, is that the weight or the impact of climate change on the world will fall very heavily on the global south. And that, in many ways, is a huge injustice, given that countries or regions like Africa are paying the price for much of the development of the Western world. I have the great pleasure today to talk to Lynley Momma. Lynley combines her human rights law background with a passion for the environment to tackle climate change and promote ecological justice. She started her quest for justice by supporting communities adversely affected by gold mining companies in Ghana and West Africa. For 5 years, she co-led the African Initiative on Mining and Environment that drafted mining legislation with communities affected by mining in Ghana. Her work with civil society was recognised in 2005 when she was appointed to represent civil society on the UN's Economic Commission for Africa Mining Vision Advisory Group that contributed to drafting the African Mining Vision of 2030. She's most recently served as the Africa Programme Director for Greenpeace Africa and WildAid and currently serves as the Global Advocacy Director of the Laudato Si movement, mobilising people of faith to protect our common home. And she's on the International Ideas Board of Advisors. Hi, Lynley.
Hello, Alistair.
Great to have you. And here we'll be talking about this challenge of the climate crisis on Africa and to hear your views on this really important subject. And firstly, though, just tell me, what is your background in climate change and democracy? How did you become interested in this topic from a personal point of view and professional? What has been your experience over the last years?
Thank you for having me. Indeed, it's a pleasure to serve as a member of the board in International Idea, and it's a pleasure to be here and sharing my insights with you on the climate crisis. How I got to be here, I think it started way back when I was a child. My dad served as a diplomat in many countries, and when he was a diplomat in Liberia in the 80s, the late 80s, that's when the Liberian Civil War broke out, and I was but less than 10 years old at the time, and we had to get out. We had to flee from the conflict, and I couldn't help, you know, as I was just, you know, we had to drive out of the country by road into Cote d'Ivoire, and I couldn't help but look at the devastating impacts of the war on such a beautiful country that at the time I had called my home. But even after the war, obviously I'd been hearing about the root causes of this conflict, and I got to study that in my latter years, and came to understand that natural resource governance and management was a huge issue, was a huge reason for the conflict, but not only in Liberia. Just later on in the years, we had the conflict diamond situation in Sierra Leone, which also had fed into the Liberian Civil War, and got me interested around, you know, natural resource governance and management, and got into studying law and human rights, and I was just very focused on social, economic, and environmental rights because of this, around natural resource governance and conflicts, and also how civil and political rights influence the enjoyment or the appreciation of social and economic rights issues. coming to understand that Africa is blessed with a plethora of natural resources and wealth, and this hasn't necessarily translated in the development of Africa, but also understanding that the exploitation of Africa's resources has largely, even from colonial times, not benefited the continent. That's why, how come I came up working on the Africa Mining Vision and supporting mining communities to be able to just, you know, be able to benefit from the resources that, you know, they've been blessed with, not just for the communities, but overall development for the continent, sustainable development for the continent. And then with the climate crisis upon us, it still brings in that element of injustice, where, first of all, our natural resources have not really benefited the continent for various reasons, including reasons that, you know, talk about democracy and governance on the continent and the ability to manage these resources, but also from colonial reasons, time back, how the resources of Africa have been exploited for the development of the West or the global North. And looking at current times where you do have a situation of a climate crisis that has not been caused by the global South, but we do have the global South that is going to bear the brunt of it, and not well prepared to deal with it.
So you came into the subject of climate change through battling mining companies, or trying to hold mining companies originally, right, to account. You came through into climate change through the legal way, right, through seeing things from that kind of legal point of view and from the kind of issue of the rule of law. This was your kind of major impetus, was it?
Exactly. So this was my background, looking at legislation that benefits communities, how legislation is implemented or not implemented, how the rule of law is supported within a country, how even constitutions ensure that, you know, social, economic and environmental rights are respected, or first of all, are enshrined in the constitution and respected. And now we see all this debate around the right to a healthy environment, which is an offspring of, you know, the climate crisis that we are in, but has been always there, even by the destruction of the environment for natural resources, be it coal and fossil fuel as we see it today and before it, and still now it was diamonds and gold, etc. So I think, you know, the extractive industry is quite interconnected with the climate crisis that we are in today. And the role of the rule of law is quite important in how that industry governs fossil fuel extraction that is ultimately falling the climate crisis.
And I guess also how civil society manages to hold account the companies within Africa, the extractive industries.
I think I'm amazed to see how the role of civil society is growing in Africa, and for many reasons. I think back in the day when we used to work in Ghana and other parts of Africa, because it was this network that I was working in, the role of civil society wasn't as much welcomed or encouraged. 20 years after, you're seeing a very active role of civil society, public interest litigation. And it was back then, don't get me wrong. We did support public interest litigation. But yeah, the role of civil society is really strengthening, especially in the light of the climate crisis, in the light of the injustices of the climate crisis, and also around citizens demanding to be heard.
Can you tell us a bit about then what I find really interesting is how the rule of law, the use of the courts, is increasingly becoming a tool of civil society. Can you give us a bit of background to this? I think a lot of people would be, you know, have an image of kind of Africa as a developing nation, which has generally had a kind of seen or perceived to have seen as kind of fragile rule of law with young democracies, young fragile democracies. But your impression, I mean, your experience is seeing something really positive in terms of what's going on with that rule of law and the challenging through court, right, of both, not just extractive industries, but of governments.
pleasantly surprised about how the rule of law is being tested in Africa, in many jurisdictions, including the African human rights systems, the African Commission on Human Rights, the African Court on Human Rights, but also in countries like Kenya, and a bit of Tanzania, where the rule of law has been tested within, you know, cold cases, I would say, where citizens' voices have been heard. But let me start in South Africa, where that's where I live. And in March, there was a High Court judgment that declared that it was unsafe for a coal mining company to get a permit to mine coal because that they didn't adhere to the levels of pollution, to air pollution, and this was in breach of Section 24, which is the constitutional right to a healthy environment. So it's popularly known as the deadly Mpumalanga's deadly air case. And this ruling actually prevented tons of carbon emission, not just for South Africa, but for the world, just because a community stood up and said, hang on, if we allow this coal project to go on, you are violating our rights to a healthy environment. You are violating our rights to a healthy lifestyle. And there have been several cases in South Africa. Most recently, there was even a coal plant in Khanyisa in South Africa, where the court said the same thing, that, you know, environmental and social impact assessments were not right. They were not conducted in the right way. And we also have seen how nuclear procurement was blocked in South Africa because civil society in 2019 challenged the executive, saying that, hey, you guys need to follow due process in order to get this nuclear deal going. And the courts came and said, you know, the right due process had not been followed. And I want to start with South Africa because it's seen as a bit more of an advanced democracy. And, you know, if something is working in South Africa, we believe that the courts are working. It's a joke that we commonly say that, you know, the courts, the system is working. Yeah, where the executive can always be challenged in courts and we expect those decisions to be enforced. So moving from South Africa and looking at other cases across the continent, we know about the Lamu case, which basically a community, the Lamu community and other civil society organizations teamed up to challenge the government and a power plant called Amu Power Plant about the level of interaction on the environmental and impact social assessments, and that it wasn't conducted well, due diligence wasn't followed, the communities were not engaged in a participatory and meaningful way. And this was challenged at the National Environmental Tribunal in Kenya. And interestingly, the tribunal did hold that, you know, the government and AMU Power had not done due diligence in consulting the Lamu people on the environmental impact assessment. So the license was not granted in the proper manner. This case has been widely celebrated on the basis that due diligence has to be followed, and was a win for civil society because it ended a coal power plant. And then, you know, well, the case ended a coal power plant and it was sent back for the environmental impact assessment to be done properly. But we also saw the likes of the African Development Bank withdrawing. We saw the likes of Chinese funding withdrawing from this because it's like, well, if the environmental impact assessment had to be done, they would have definitely done properly. There are loopholes in that because the climate considerations were not taken. So I think the Lamu case does point to a fact that a people, a community, well supported with civil society coming together, can challenge big coal power plants, big donors, and challenge them in the courts, and the courts being progressive enough to rule against the government.
When we say progressive enough, then, one, Do you think that that kind of court ruling would have happened, say, 20 years ago? Does it testify to a growing independence and strengthening of courts, across the likes of East Africa, or in particular Kenya? What's the case of the actual courts? Is there essentially a strengthening of the rule of law in terms of judges being able to act independently?
Yes, but there are other factors too that I would say constitutions across the world are increasingly recognizing the right to a healthy environment, the right to free, prior and informed consent, the right to be heard. And when these are enshrined in the constitutions, they will be tested. So that's one. But also there is the spotlight now on these constitutions to be upheld in court. So by a combination of these factors, we are seeing an increased respect for the rule of law in African countries, with Lamu being a case in point. I also think that information, free media, is also helping this process. And I say that because 20 years ago, media was not as, information was not as fluid. Right now, you have a situation where community members are actively engaged by partners internationally and nationally, by social media, by use of the internet, etc. And even with the pandemic, we've seen that, communication can still happen. And so we need to take, that's one of the reasons. So I wouldn't necessarily say, yes, the rule of law has been strengthened, but it has been strengthened by these other factors. And also just to say that, the right to be heard, the right to say no, is a concept that many communities are increasingly embracing, and this is being strengthened by the courts. And this is not just for court projects, by the way. The Himba people in Botswana are opposing a hydropower plant, which could be seen as clean energy, because it infringes on their indigenous and communal rights, on their traditional and cultural beliefs. So it works both ways. And I hold that, you cannot infringe on one right to guarantee the other right. So you cannot infringe on the right to free, prior, informed consent for communities like this because you want to have to implement the right to a healthy environment or not. All these rights should be treated equally. So I think that also the concept of the interdependence of rights is also evolving.
How are these judgments being enforced? Is there a sense that the courts make headlines by ruling in one direction, but obviously the challenge we see across the world is enforcing these judgments. How is that going along?
I earlier on referred to the African human rights system, and I would like to talk about the certain cases that the African Commission on Human and People's Rights have dealt with. For example, the Serac case was one case in point that even in the early days of the commission enforced the right to a healthy environment and directed the government of Nigeria to make sure that, the exploration of oil doesn't impact on the right to health, the right to life, the right to land, etc., the right to a healthy environment. However, there is a question of enforceability at that level. So the African Commission on Human and People's Rights and the African Courts is one of the three regional courts. So you have the European Court of Human Rights, and you have the Inter-American Courts, and you have the African Courts. Unfortunately, we are seeing that the African Courts, even the cases that are brought before the African Courts, is not... They have very progressive rulings, but it's not being enforced by some member states. The Ogake community in Kenya did bring a case before the African court where they were being evicted from the Mau forest, and they were like, this is our land, we've been here all throughout, and the African courts upheld the rights to indigenous people to have their say, to stay on this land, which is a very progressive case, again, upholding the rights of communities. But these decisions have not been forced. And we are actually seeing a withdrawal of African institutions from the trust of the African courts. So, for example, some countries like Rwanda, Tanzania, Benin and Cote d'Ivoire have actually withdrawn their permission for the courts to have any jurisdiction over them. By doing so, they're actually not only saying, well, we don't respect you, but also just saying we are preventing you from having any future rulings against us. So it's unfortunate that these very progressive decisions at the regional level are not being implemented. However, at the national level, there is some degree of compliance. I've seen South Africa, coal companies have been stopped. The Lamu case that I talked about, that is basically dead. By the fact that there was this ruling of the court, but also because I think the financiers of these projects, like, you know, the African Development Bank and the Chinese funders also, you know, pulled away from them. So even though sometimes the court rulings may not be enforced at the regional level, but the fact that these progressive decisions are being made also points to a pattern that other institutions are willing to follow.
And how much is this use of the role of your, you know, the use of courts is obviously, as you were saying, right, is about the strengthening or a sign of the strengthening of civil society, you know, from how much is that about a younger generation, you know, with more self-confidence, using, as you talked again about, you know, social media to gain publicity about companies that aren't doing, you know, the right thing? Is this a generational trend, you know, within parts of Africa? How would you kind of qualify, you know, define what's going on?
I think the younger generation are really challenging the older ones and those in power right now, even on the critical issues around the climate crisis. Because for all intents and purposes, we could say that the age of the ruling governments now, or people in power, might not experience the impacts, although that is a fallacy because the climate crisis is real. Yeah, it is real. The impacts are being felt. So to say that maybe the older generation might not experience this, I think is a fallacy. However, the younger, the youth have more at stake. Yeah, some of them might not have even heard about some of the forests and some of the things that we enjoyed when we were kids. And it's really encouraging to see the rise of youth activism in South Africa, well, in Africa in general. Two weeks ago, we supported a young activist, Vanessa, to take part in a tour of Europe to denounce the East African crude oil pipeline. And within my current organization, we facilitated a visit for her to have audience with the Pope. And just having a picture opportunity with Pope Francis with the sign Stop ECOP traveled around the world to say, hey, hang on, the Pope is taking notice of this crude oil pipeline in East Africa. The church is taking notice of that. So it's amazing the power of the youth, but it's also amazing the power of, you know, this age of digital media and information technology, where images, you know, get to travel so fast. And I feel like that is an opportunity that the younger generation have seized and are running with it to safeguard their future.
This is also part of, like, I guess, a wider movement, right? It's not just about the rule of law. There's lots of other things going on, I imagine, in Africa in terms of communities and younger generations or older generations fighting for or against, not the whole trend towards the climate crisis. There's a need to change other aspects. I mean, we're looking at things like the lobbying groups, you know, corruption, you know, how political parties are run. What do you think, outside that issue just straight of the rule of law, what are the other issues do you think that this new generations or new groups are looking at to change?
It's interesting you mentioned lobbying and corruption and, you know, companies, etc. I was just making a point the other day to say that, you know, once a company either pays a lobbying group to advance their policy, it's corruption. And sometimes it's seen as corruption in the global south, but it could be called something else in the global north. It could be called lobbying. It is corruption. So I think there's a role to fight that. There's a role to say no to companies that are coming in to take advantage of natural resources or are even exacerbating the climate crisis through fossil fuels. But there's also a role to embrace new renewable energy technologies, noting that they cannot trample on the rule of law. They cannot dismiss the rule of law because this is a renewable technology and its rights. Yeah. So I just wanted to put that out there, that even clean energy or clean energy should not be seen as, you know, we're going to do clean energy and we're going to trample on community rights. So the rule of law should always be respected. And the rights of the community should always be respected. I think free media has also accounted for this. I mentioned this earlier that, you know, even though African governments are still trying to suppress the right to free speech, etc. I mean, we saw that in Nigeria where, you know, internet shut down, etc. This is something that cannot be done for a long time. It could be done for a day or two at most. But people are increasingly voicing their concerns in different ways. In different ways, which may not necessarily be at the poll or the voting stations. They are voicing their concerns through so many ways of citizen participation. Communities are learning how to say no. Communities are learning how to protest. Different groups are coming up. And different influencers also. You know, I used to work with Wilded, and the role of influencers is quite notable on how influencers can direct a particular policy or direct just influence government in itself. So I think the many ways in which citizens' voices are being heard that is strengthening democracy, I think it's also strengthening the rule of law.
Lastly, I think the last kind of main issue I wanted to talk to you about is the issue of climate justice. Mm. So all this context of the rule of law, of communities, you know, battling companies, raising their voices, comes in the context, though, of you do need development. Africa does need economic growth. It does need to fortify. It needs to battle poverty, etc. But it's situated in a world where it's being asked to cut this, to make sure it doesn't build coal stations, etc. But there's all this concept, essentially, of climate justice. How do you think this issue of climate justice, how do you feel it fits in the African context and in the context of this battle of, you know, many local communities and groups over climate change?
Ken Sarowiwa, of the Ogoni people, he had said that the environment is a community's first right. It's a people's first right. Many indigenous communities in Africa have had a very inter-spiritual connection, ethnocentric connection with the environment, a lot from the cultural practices, etc. And this view that we see today of environment to benefit humankind is one that originally was foreign, to historically foreign. And when we talk about the history of this, I think I should go back, way back, as even the colonial times, when natural resource governance was absent. It was dictated by colonial masters and still is today. where natural resources were just extracted for the benefits of the colonial regimes. And those ties have not really been cut. They've not really been severed until the point where we have a situation that Africa has failed to benefit from its natural resources. And I do not blame this in any way only on external industries or companies or colonial regimes. There's also a complicit involvement of African governments and their failure to manage these natural resources for the development of their people. But we see today that in spite of this all, coal has pushed development. Fossil fuel has pushed development in the global north. The industrialization process, etc., have been enhanced by fossils. Yeah, and that is that gives a historical contribution of the north towards the climate crisis. On the other hand, you see African countries that have not benefited from this, but will bear the brunt of the climate crisis. And I just want to put it here that it is a topic where sometimes it can be seen that, well, we have to pay for, you know, your inability to manage your resources and your inability to govern yourself. That is a fallacy, because you cannot talk about any form of right without talking about the injustices, correcting the injustices of the past and the present, and in this case, the future. There's no rights, enjoyment of rights, when there's a blatant injustice as one we experience now. You have small island states who are going to disappear, but you also have a lot of African countries who are not prepared to deal with the climate crisis. We had 400 plus people lost last week in Durban, in South Africa, last week because of floods, buildings covered, the insurance industry is suffering. So can I just say that the climate crisis is not just going to hurt communities in Africa, it's also going to hurt business. Yeah. So coming back to environmental injustice in Africa, I think it should be considered as a privilege for countries of the global north to want to remedy these wrongs, as opposed to, well, we can do it if we have all the resources. The mere fact of speaking of justice means that you're willing to accept the wrongs of the past and ready to remedy it. So there's a good case to be made for loss and damage, which doesn't come from the fact that I'm pleading. Doesn't come from the fact that African countries are pleading for loss and damage. $100 billion has been promised. It should be a privilege of the global north to produce that.
An issue of justice.
An issue of justice. It should be something that African countries should not be ashamed to talk about. What we risk is that African countries can take a different pathway of development, because Africa wants to develop and they will develop. And that is clear. You see the African Agenda 2063, you see every development plan, you see every national action plan in Africa, there is the element of development in it for several reasons. Maybe there's a catch-up element to it also. And what we hear today in the political circles is that how we develop, whether we're given technical assistance enough, we have the natural resources. But the question is, are we prepared to keep the fossil fuels in the ground and, you know, enable all the sustainable, cleaner ways of development for the continent and solve these injustices? Or are we going to bury our head in the sand and say, well, so be it? The truth is Africa is on the quest for development. Whether they go the clean way or the dirty way, it's up for grabs. So coming back to the injustices, it should not be. It's a very tricky issue, and I feel like an African, we always have to be the ones advocating for this social injustice. You know, we always have to be the ones saying it. I think it's high time that the global north realize that, you know what, we need to correct the wrongs of the past and do this effortlessly.
Thanks, Lyndon. That's been really interesting. I think one of the things that I've learned just with this conversation is the sense of empowerment that obviously is going on with these communities and, you know, and younger generations within Africa, the sense of solutions to, you know, this problem. It's a long way ahead, but it's been a very interesting conversation. And thanks very much indeed.
Thank you for listening to the Democracy Ideas podcast. Keep following International Idea on social media. We need all of you to participate in constructing better societies. Goodbye.